Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm Andy Davis. Venturi's Voice brings together thought leaders from a variety of industries who are taking the most innovative approaches to leadership and staffing. Imagine having a mix of experienced mentors sharing their secrets on leadership, recruiting, onboarding, engagement, and motivating, as well as stories on life lessons they've learned along the way. And it's free. If you're the head of a major corporation leading a team of hundreds or about to take on your first leadership role, this podcast is for you. This show is about you, and we're here to help you become the best leader you can be. Stay up to date with the latest shows by subscribing on iTunes and SoundCloud, as well as signing up to the newsletter at venturi-group.com, where you can find the latest IT jobs, talent, and blogs on all things leadership, staffing, and development. I'd love to hear from you, so drop me a line anytime via email at andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback or requests are always welcome. Enjoy the show.
Today's guest is Simon Finney, Group Strategic Project Director at Langer Rourke. Great to have you on the show, Simon. I definitely want to, there's definitely some things I want to get kind of your opinion on, advice on, but above all else, obviously, I'm intrigued to kind of hear a little bit about your kind of background and story. So I think just for pure context, do you want to kind of give us a bit of a rundown of kind of your background and kind of what you're up to these days?
Yeah, sure. So I, after university, I actually joined the RAF as a psychologist and worked with fast jet pilots on decision making, because obviously, you know, they think it's very much instinct, but you've got to train that instinct into people because they've got milliseconds to react to, you know, events that happen up in the air. And so the MOD was pouring a lot of money into trying to support these guys, you know, who are, you know, cost millions to train and are in control of, you know, £1 million worth of hardware. And so we were coming at it from a psychological point of view. How could we counsel them and coach them for better decision making and get the feedback from what they've done? So it was really interesting. What I found was that kind of work, I presented on it at a couple of conferences, and it's exactly that the corporate world was looking for as well at the time, and this is back in the mid 90s. So I ended up joining Arthur Andersen as a management consultant, working with corporate clients to improve the decision making within their organizations. And that was it was a great leap. I mean, it was really interesting work, very exciting. Worked with a really wide range of clients, everyone from, I think we did some work for Disney, we did some work for some of the Unilever, some of the other FMCG kind of companies. So really interesting kind of work. It was really good. And then from there, and I know I'd always been quite interested in technology as well. And so at that time, and again, it was a bit of a flavor of the time because we were just approaching the kind of dot-com kind of era, the first dot-com era in the late 90s. We were very much interested in how could IT and technology automate the kind of transactional stuff that was all rule-based and allow people to concentrate on the really knowledge-based activities and decisions. So I did some work. I kind of moved across into the legal sector where I implemented a number of different legal drafting pieces of software that relied upon artificial intelligence to and things like, I think they called it the smart documents, but essentially you'd embed all these rules in so that rather than, as lawyers love to do, starting with a blank sheet of paper and drafting a contract or agreement from scratch, actually you'd answer a series of questions and it would produce you the first draft automatically. It would never be, you know, correct and the final draft, but it would save you a huge amount of time and it would get you kind of 90% of the way there. And so that was really interesting. And I remember working on a project to implement that across Edinburgh, Singapore, New York and Paris, and trying to get those guys all onto the same page in terms of how to actually implement this was an absolute nightmare. But it was a really good project in the end, and those guys went on to use it in earnest. So really good. From there, my career kind of then branched out into how do you design operating models and design your organization to maximize resources and deliver the strategy. So I kind of moved more into how do you help organizations shape their strategy and then actually deliver it through restructuring their organization. And I did that in a number of companies. By this time, I'd moved across into a much smaller consultancy called Detica, and we did a bit of public sector work around that. So we did some reshaping of police forces and the Home Office, did some telco clients as well as some financial services clients. And so the focus there was very much on efficiency and how you can deliver the strategy in the most efficient and effective kind of way. That was fine. Then, because the financial crisis happened 2007, there was very much almost every organization I was talking to at that point in time was talking about cost reduction, you know. And I always used to say to clients, you know, if you want to reduce your cost base and your overhead cost base by, say, 10%, that's fine. You know, you can run a slide rule across your budget. That's not a problem. If you're looking for around 20%, you're going to have to do some form of reorganization on the back of it. And if you're after 30%, which is what many of them are after, you're looking at a completely different operating model or even business model in many cases. So, and at that point in time, there was so much uncertainty about the global economy. Lots of clients were saying, we're aiming for the 30%. We want, you know, even if things get better, we want to use this opportunity to completely restructure our business. So I did a lot of work in oil and gas, for example, with BP, in mining, with, for example, with Anglo American, which was very much focused on, right, the strategy needs to be the most efficient and effective organization. How can we restructure the organization to achieve that? As an example, I spent 6 months down in South Africa with the new chief exec of Anglo Platinum, Chris Griffith. And he had come in very much with an aim of, we need to get this organization fit to either stay within the wider Anglo American or even to potentially to be sold. All options are on the table. And so we completely restructured that company, which hadn't really been touched for, you know, kind of 50 years. And the way we did that was we said, okay, what's the overall value chain? Where is the money actually created in this organization? That we need to make as seamless as possible. And then everything else should be driven by, you know, how it supports those key processes. Great piece of work. Got implemented. Very painful. A lot of labor disputes there. I mean, I was there during the Marikana strike where 43 people unfortunately lost their lives when workers clashed with police in the Rustenburg area. Very nasty business. But in the end, we got that company into a position where everybody's jobs were safe. And there were actually minimal redundancies on the back of it, you know, but it was restructured in a way that maximized the efficiency of the business. So it's been that kind of work I've tended to do on the consultancy side. I then moved in-house and I joined the Kier Group as their group performance director to essentially do the same kind of work, but from inside the organization. I sat on the executive board there and actually drove through exactly the same piece of work, you know, to help define the strategy. We recruited a strategy director who's now in post, who then took that on. And then I was all about driving that strategy into a series of targeted transformation initiatives. So, for example, one of them was set up group procurement, which didn't exist. So we set that up or centralized the fleet function and make it a profit center rather than a cost center. So we did that and various other changes around things like employee terms and conditions. And it's really interesting. I met up with the chief exec of Kier not that long ago. Now that I've left, and he said, if you had told me 5 years ago that what you need is a group performance director, I would have said to you, you know, you're absolutely mad. You know, no, finance and commercial do that kind of work. Why would we need it? But he said, I absolutely get the logic of it now. You need a focal point within your organization for change. You need someone whose neck is on the block to make sure that things change to deliver the strategy. Otherwise, if you only leave it to the executives in charge of the P&L or the support functions, it's just too hard for them to change from where they are, you know, where they currently are to where they need to be on their own. So, which was really interesting. So I was at Kier for 4 years. I then have more recently taken an opportunity at the turn of the year to join Lang O'Rourke to do a very similar role. My role there is Group Strategic Projects Director, and essentially we're in the process of reviewing and refreshing the strategy, and I'm working with all of the execs to get a series of change initiatives in place, mainly focused on the technical function, certainly initially, to deliver those changes, you know, that are required. So very interesting.
It's fascinating. Well, I think just a fascinating time to have been in strategy has been the last kind of 10 years. You have the banking crisis, which, as you pointed out, meant that people have to reduce their overheads. There's an overall panic. And then we've kind of moved even more so into kind of this streamlining automation time that we're kind of going through at the moment, where people are just, you know, really able to streamline a lot more. We're using technology. Has technology, I'd be interested kind of what role that's played in how you've approached strategy over the last sort of 10 years and what impact that's had on the decisions that you've allowed to make. Has it kind of been, you know, a great ally of yours when looking at new strategies and restructuring?
It absolutely has. I mean, I kind of bang out the old idiom, which is technology needs to be an enabler. It's not an end in itself. So you need to establish what you want the business model to actually be, and what the strategy needs to be linked to that. And once you've established that, technology has to be the enabler to get you there. I've been party to a number of technology driven transformation programs, and quite often I go right back to basics and say, you know, what's the business case for this? Are we doing this just because the technology's there and because all of our competitors are, you know, and SAP and Oracle's a great example of that, you know, we need to have ERP. Well, why? Well, because all of our competitors have got it. And for me, that's not enough. It needs to go back and say, you know, what's the business case? And in many cases, that does lead you back to SAP and Oracle as options, you know, but it needs to be, what's the original business justification? Now, I was very much into artificial intelligence when I was at university. It went through, and I think they refer to it as the dark years, because basically computing power just was not able to provide support to all the solutions that were being designed and developed in the artificial intelligence space. Now, 20 years later, we're in a really exciting place where the computing power is there to support artificial intelligence. And there's some really interesting things out there. Now, many of them are badged as AI, and they're not, but there's some great stuff on machine learning and things like, you know, contact centers and the use of chatbots, you know, and areas like this. Really interesting, and some great opportunities. As I'm sure you know, we really suffer in the UK from low productivity. On a per capita basis, you know, our GDP is just not where it needs to be, and we fall behind. And I think there's some great opportunities here to use automation and more digital technology to make us more efficient. And people say, oh, well, you know, and I can't remember what the stats, but tens of thousands or, you know, hundreds of thousands of jobs could be at risk if we automate. And I really do think that's a backward space. You know, it's really, really Luddite kind of mentality, because we will always find jobs. There's always more to do. There's always new markets that can be developed. So we shouldn't try and push back technology. We should try and harness it for good, really.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've been through it before as well. It's what everyone seems to forget. You know, we've been through it with the Industrial Revolution. So, I mean, it's people, there's new skills that are going to be, need to be incorporated. But, you know, the opportunity for something like AI and the application is the most exciting thing, in my opinion. It doesn't even come close to anything else, really. I mean, I know you can kind of look at blockchain and things like that are quite interesting at the moment, decentralization, but this is literally on the verge of kind of, you know, really, really having an impact on the world, and in a much more positive light than I think that, you know, he potentially gets credit for. But I think that's with anything. There's always this hesitation with change. So it's inevitable that people are going to perceive it in a negative light initially, until we see, how prolific it might be for us. And, I think someone like you, who's always looking at things from a macro perspective, can really see the application as a vastly positive thing. Especially when you look at, as you said, the lack in productivity in the UK, it can certainly have, a great impact on things like that. And, if it takes a technology like this to do so, why wouldn't we take full advantage of this? It's interesting, actually. I wanted to talk a little bit about your early days in psychology. So psychology is like a it's something that, looking back on, I really wish I'd have studied when I was in university and had the time to. I still might, spend some time and look at it. I had a particular interest. My background's economics, so I have like a particular interest in behavioral economics. I just find it fascinating. It really takes into account the variables that kind of standardized economics doesn't. And obviously psychology is essentially like that variable that is kind of the other half of the economics that kind of makes behavioral economics. And I think it's, so applicable into the workplace, because I think that standardized business practice economics and whatever, they just don't take the variable into consideration. And the main variable is people. And that's as simple as that. It's people are the reason why nothing is predictable. And psychology obviously takes those into consideration. I mean, when you're kind of building a strategy, I wonder how much of that economics plays a role on, if you have if you're forecasting or you're, building in strategies. I even kind of do it now when I'm rolling out new things. You have to take the inevitability of things like, well, yeah, this makes sense. People should just be able to do it. People will just do this. So there's always that lag, and that comes from people for a number of different reasons that you can't even fathom, probably.
Correct. Correct.
So how, how much of a role does that kind of play now into your building of new strategies and streamlining all the kind of rest all the rest of it?
I mean, it's absolutely square and center. So, and like you, I'm really passionate about psychology. I love the behavioral economics kind of side of it as well, the Stephen Levitt, the Freakonomics, or everything from there to the kind of nudge principle and things like that. So, absolutely. I think for me, the main area where it's impacted has been less about in defining the strategy. It's about the execution of the strategy and about how to get people bought into it and behave in a way that they're coming together to deliver that strategy for the corporate good. So, if I give a very kind of low level example, when we tried to harmonize terms and conditions at a company I was working with, we ended up spending a lot of time, but it was well placed time to work on the messaging and about how it would be perceived, and we got some focus groups as well involved to get feedback from those to make sure that this was seen in a positive light as something good for the company rather than something that was just being kind of dictated top down. And I know lots of companies that have gone through big kind of employee changes. I mean, the biggest one of recent years has been the move away from final salary pensions to defined contribution pensions, and so many of them have been handled badly. I mean, they say that. I mean, it's an on-running kind of thing that 70% of change projects don't meet their kind of their original kind of business case or requirements. And Kotter does that analysis on a regular basis. And I think a lot of that is down to the fact that people fail to incorporate. Sorry, drivers of change fail to incorporate people and how and people's perception and how they'll engage with that change. Meaningfully, it's really difficult. I mean, and you're never going to get it right. I mean, even some of the best behavioral psychologists in the world, will stand up and say, we don't understand all human behavior. I mean, they can't. It's just far too complex, and you just can't map it out. But you can. It can support some of your decision making and help identify where some of the risks are in actually driving through transformation.
Was that So when you're rolling out new strategies, how much, I mean, this is just from a layman's perspective on a much smaller scale, but before rolling things out, is it okay, you can't really, I wonder how you test a restructuring or how you kind of generate feedback to try and, approach things in kind of a lean, agile way. Is it even possible to do that?
It is in some cases, but it's not in others. So, I've worked with companies where they've literally said, we've got 6 months to get this organization in the right place. Otherwise, we're going to be financially distressed, essentially. So, sometimes you don't have the luxury, because it does take time and there's time and energy. When I led the integration of the Michelle business, which was acquired by Kia a couple of years ago, I had a lady working with me, Susie Cross, who's absolutely phenomenal on the communications, the engagement, the whole change management piece. And between the two of us, we put in place a number of different activities to try and welcome that the people who were part of the Michelle group into Kia, including, we sent out cupcakes to everyone, a welcome bag, explaining exactly what the strategy of the overall company was and where they sat in the company. We set up a website for them to go on and get all the stuff that you just normally don't have on day one. So everything from expense policy to car policy to how health and safety worked in the organization. And what was really interesting, certainly for me, and I consider myself a relatively an early adopter, but even I had clocked that this was going to happen, was people who were part of the acquired company went on, were taking photos of the cupcakes, photos of the goodie bags, and putting them on social media and tagging Kia and basically saying, great to feel wanted for the first time, still early days, but Kia's made a really good kind of first impression on our first day. All the signs had changed on the building and everything. And it's those kind of, they seem very soft and in some ways quite small scale and tactical, but actually when you add them all up, it conveys an overall impression of the kind of psychological relationship between an employer and an employee, and it helps drive through those changes.
Yeah, and it helps. I mean, all of this kind of productivity, these are the things that I think are massively overlooked. Kind of one of the reasons, I suppose, as a slight side note, but still relevant, is one of the reasons why I wanted to start the podcast is because I spent time out in LA and London building startups, and when I kind of left that world and went kind of corporate instead. I drew perspective on kind of my experiences, and I've engaged with hundreds of startups, maybe even thousands of different startups over my time through various incubators, etc. And the one commonality, and when you kind of try and add up which ones managed to be successful, it's not necessarily that the concept was better than everything else, because there was a lot of really, really compelling concepts that made a hell of a lot of sense. But what I found to be consistent was the companies that managed to put the people first, even though they were low on resources. So the people who really nailed down the dynamics internally, even when they were low on resources, weren't able to hire in HR, but still found the time to try and make the environment as comfortable as possible and as engaging as possible for the small team that they had. They seem to be the ones that managed to have the successes, and I don't think it was a coincidence whatsoever. So obviously, when I wanted to start the podcast, and we got in and started working with Venturi, who were obviously involved in kind of the people HR staffing scene, it made perfect sense to kind of build a podcast and really try and highlight the importance of people, and it's such an overlooked aspect amongst all industry. And as you speak of, even the small things, it's things like that that make all the difference. People who come into work engaged versus not engaged. If you have 20% of your workforce that's not engaged, that's essentially 20% less productivity, but they're still going to come to work every day because they need to get paid. So you're carrying that burden because you didn't make the effort up front. So it's we talk very lightly about these things, but they make such an impact from my experience, and it's really fascinating, but very hard to quantify those results, which I think is why they're so overlooked.
I think you're absolutely right, and we kind of joke about some of the kind of Silicon Valley startups and the fact that they provide, ping pong tables and sushi chefs in-house and all this kind of stuff. But actually, it's about creating a nice place to work where you feel comfortable to do your best. And that's what you want from every employee is for them to do their best. And I get dismayed sometimes, because in the UK especially, and there was a survey that came out yesterday, it said 88% of UK organisations are focused on cost reduction, this year. And I think that's, while that's admirable, and which you should be as lean and as effective of your cost base as possible, there is a business case for investing in things that employees notice, such as childcare, such as fringe benefits within the group, but also just as good working environments, that are provide as much support as possible to employees. So it's something that mustn't get lost as part of the overall trying to get us get an organization match fit.
And the problem with this is as well, I think, is that there's no linear way to achieve it, and that's the hard bit. There's like and I think it speaks volumes for, really good kind of HR people team, doesn't it? Someone who can kind of make those adjustments, because, we talk about the Silicon Valley stuff and the ping pong tables and all that. I actually worked for a company in London that had like ping pong tables and all that kind of stuff in the office, and that's not what makes the culture. That's not what keeps you engaged and coming into work, actually. It's much bigger than that. It's the kind of interactions on a day-to-day basis with the people. It's, a multitude of different things. Maybe that plays a bigger role in someone's work than other people would. But again, there's no linear path, and this is the difficulty with it. So yeah, I think it speaks volumes for a really good, HR kind of head of people, as actually I interviewed the head of people, as they call it, instead of like the head of talent, head of HR at SoundCloud quite recently, and she's just a fascinating woman, absolutely fascinating woman, and doing just an incredible job over there. Her impact, though it won't, it's not directly, attributed to sales or whatever, I would argue is as big of impact as anyone else in the organization,
I was talking to a friend of a friend who works for Google in London, and he was saying that, and he hasn't been there that long, but their use of data is phenomenal, as you'd obviously expect. And he got an email saying, by the way, we've got the data on security access for one of your employees and the times that they've been coming in and going. And he thought, all right, where's this going to go? And they said they've been regularly putting in too many hours. And we're worried about them, that they're spending too much time in the office. Can you just check in with them and make sure that they're not, stressed or overburdened in some way? And he thought that, that is exactly what HR, the service that HR should be supporting. And the data and the systems and the technology should be there to support the conversations, to support the interaction between line managers and employees to make sure that, everyone's working well and to the best of their ability.
I agree. I agree. I mean, how much of an impact does that kind of play in your role? Is that, I suppose, do you have those kind of interactions with HR, or I suppose is it kind of, you're working on a higher level, and I hope people understand what higher level means and not
I mean, I think the issue you've got is that in the construction sector, where I've been now for a number of years, the systems and technology are behind other sectors. So we don't have we haven't always had the information and the data support that. Despite that, though, I would say that the HR teams I've worked in, both Laing O'Rourke and Kier recently, and before that, Balfour Beatty and other, have been phenomenal in their dedication because they recognize it's absolutely a people business. So I've seen people, succeed despite having the support of the technology. I mean, one of the things that attracted me to Laing O'Rourke was the whole technology piece, because it's doing a lot of work in offsite manufacturing, which has got to be the future for the construction sector. And the capability in house, every day I learn more about what it's capable of. It's just a phenomenal business in terms of that. But the issue is trying to get the clients and the market and to come together with that solution to make a really compelling business case. And it happens, but it's just harder work than the traditional design and build contracts that tend to come out.
Interesting. Yeah, very interesting. I've got a note here that I actually wanted to ask, and I wanted to talk about a little bit, and it's still kind of relevant, but distractions that kind of work, and working in this kind of multi-screen environment that we currently live in. And I think distractions is such a interesting topic of how to kind of deal with it, and it's become more and more of a problem, obviously, along with technology. You're probably a man who's kind of, has the carrot dangling in front of him in various ways of distracting you, including me bringing you on a podcast in the middle of the week. Yeah. But how do you actually deal with distractions personally? How do you kind of manage your time now in this kind of environment? What's kind of been your approach and generate kind of the most success for you?
Yeah, it is really difficult because technology has been phenomenal at making it so easy to access information all the time. I mean, I try and be relatively disciplined. I get into the office relatively early, and up until 9 o'clock, so that gives me, a nice chunk of time to clear emails, to look in stuff. And, I'm notorious at following links on emails and just having a quick route around just so I understand the subject. But I think after that, then I try and get into, seeing people. My diary tends to be pretty full anyway, in the core parts of the day, relatively back to back meeting people. That said, we have a weekly governance forum where we go through everything that's happening in our area. I've agreed with the others around the table. It has to be a no laptop, no iPad, no mobile discussion, because the minute you see someone just tapping away in the corner, I certainly question why they're even in the room. Okay, so if you're going to invest the time being in a meeting, you've got to be there. And someone said to me, and this is about 10 years ago, when I did suffer more from this, you say, Simon, you've got to be present. You've got to be there, and I absolutely agree with that. And that means, switching off all the black screens, and just putting them down and engaging with the people around the table. And I think that's absolutely essential.
Yeah, I agree. And it's difficult now, I think, to kind of get this quality time in with people, the more and more that we kind of look at remote and that's more accessible to us. That's a whole nother thing, isn't it? Being able to kind of manage people on remote, which I'm sure you kind of have to deal with as well.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to kind of create that environment sometimes now. And we have to figure out a way how to achieve that, I think.
Yeah. But I mean, again, a little kind of, there's lots of jokes and videos and gags online about conference calls that go wrong and people with dogs barking in the background and all this kind of stuff. But I mean, if you genuinely know that someone is just tapping away, not really engaging on a conference call, I'd be having a quiet word and saying, do you even really want to attend? Is this a good use of your time? So I think, and there's shades of grey there, that they're absolutely. I mean, video conferencing is fantastic, but I always think video conferencing with people you've never met in the flesh before is really hard. You've got to build up an initial rapport before you can rely upon video conferencing, exclusively,
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. It's good. And, staying focused, kind of, eliminating distractions. These are all things that we kind of, it's just an ongoing battle, especially for me. I'm constantly going into that. I try and do a day from home here and there if I have a particular project. For someone like you, there's a lot of kind of creative thinking, I suppose, involved in what you're doing as well, and you need that time to be able to think clearly. I kind of look at it as there's two different stages in my role. It's kind of, the actual strategy part of it, and then there's the actual doing. And I think what a lot of people get stuck in is the constant doing, and your weeks go by where it's just, you know, constant just doing, and you don't get that time to kind of step back and think about things. You know, and I find that something that, you know, I struggle with, and I have to kind of remind myself to kind of take that step back.
And again, I remember, and this is, everything feels like about 10 years ago now, but yeah, you know, so about 10 years ago, a partner who I was working for said, of a chief exec we were working with, this guy's great. He separates the important from the urgent. And I'll never forget him saying that, because that's absolutely right. A key skill as you get more and more senior in an organization is being able to separate out the stuff that's screaming away because it's urgent and the stuff that's genuinely important. And I've, you know, I made no bones about it. If I've got to write a, you know, board paper, for instance, I will block that time out of my diary, and I will go and find somewhere where I can't be online, for example, and I will just hamper up until it's done. You know, it's just, it's, and when I used to travel by air a lot, I used to love the fact that there was no Wi-Fi, because you could just get the laptop out and you just power through all the stuff that you occasionally got, you know, disturbed by and never got a clear run at. So very, very useful.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's necessary. And I think it's necessary regardless of like kind of what point you're in at as well. I think, you know, if you're, even if you're early in your career, you're relatively junior, it's still important to have that time and have perspective and think about what you're actually doing. I think there's so many people who, like, they just go through day to day, and I don't think they have that time to kind of draw perspective and think, right, why, where am I going with this? You know, it's actually, like, incredible how many people don't. They kind of get something, and then from the point they get the job, there's very little kind of overriding thought about what it actually all means and what they're actually working towards, and, you know, how does it fit into the picture and what you like and the vision for your career, etc. So yeah, I think it's important to try and find that time, you know, and I definitely encourage people to figure out some sort of way where you can kind of be away from, you know, social media and, you know, Slack messaging and email and stuff like that, at least like, you know, at least some period of time each day, I think is definitely doable, you know, whether you, even if it's just an hour away from it, you know, that time's important to actually have a think. And, you know, for me, it's like, I actually do like to listen to, you know, to podcasts and stuff like that, you know, on my kind of downtime, and, you know, just try and think about things, you know, so it's downtime where I'm actually still thinking about stuff, but it just helps me kind of draw perspective and on whether it's a, you know, a strategy meeting, or whether it's, you know, or whether it's kind of a point in my infliction in my career, so on and so forth. Yeah, definitely encourage people to try and do that, and I'm sure you'll tell me that the psychological benefits for that as well.
Well, there absolutely are. There absolutely are.
Fascinating. I really enjoyed it. I want to talk to you some more and definitely stay connected, because you know, there's so many things I think that, you know, you could probably offer advice to across a multitude of things.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. Please make sure you subscribe at iTunes or SoundCloud, or check out the website venturi-group.com, and keep up to date with the latest IT jobs, talent, news, and podcasts. Or drop me a line. It's andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback, topics, or guest suggestions are always welcome. And thanks again for listening to the show. See you next time.